Book 2, The Spirit World, or World of Spirits. Chapter 1, Spirits. 76. What definition can be given of spirits? Spirits may be defined as the intelligent beings of the creation. They constitute the population of the universe, in contradistinction to the forms of the material world. Note. The word spirit is here employed to designate the individuality of extracorporeal beings, and not the universal intelligent element. 77. Are spirits beings distinct from the deity, or are they only emanations from or portions of the deity, and called, for that reason, sons or children of God? Spirits are the work of God, just as a machine is the work of the mechanic who made it. The machine is the man's work, but it is not the man. You know that when a man has made a fine or useful thing, he calls it his child, his creation. It is thus with us in relation to God. We are his children in this sense, because we are his work. 78. Have spirits had a beginning, or have they existed, like God, from all eternity? If spirits had not had a beginning, they would be equal with God, whereas they are his creation, and subject to his will. That God has existed from all eternity is incontestable, but as to when and how he created us, we know nothing. You may say that we have had no beginning in this sense, that, God being eternal, he must have incessantly created. But as to when and how each of us was made, this, I repeat, is known to no one. It is the great mystery. 79. Since there are two general elements in the universe, the intelligent element and material element, would it be correct to say that spirits are formed from the intelligent element as inert bodies are formed from the material element? It is evident that such is the case. Spirits are the individualization of the intelligent principle, as bodies are the individualization of the material principle. It is the epoch and mode of this formation that are unknown to us. 80. Is the creation of spirits always going on? Or did it only take place at the beginning of time? It is always going on, that is to say, God has never ceased to create. 81. Are spirits formed spontaneously, or do they proceed from one another? God creates them as he creates all other creatures, by his will. But we must again repeat that their origin is a mystery. 82. Is it correct to say that spirits are immaterial? How is it possible to define a thing in regard to which no terms of comparison exist, and which your language is incompetent to express? Can one who is born blind define light? Immaterial is not the right word, incorporeal would be nearer the truth, for you must understand that a spirit, being a creation, must be something real. Spirit is quintessentialized matter, but matter existing in a state which has no analog within the circle of your comprehension, and so ethereal that it could not be perceived by your senses. 83. Is there an end to the duration of spirits? We can understand that the principle from which they emanate should be eternal. But what we desire to know is, whether their individuality has a term, and whether, after a given lapse of time, longer or shorter, the element from which they are formed is not disseminated, does not return to the mass from which they were produced, as is the case with material bodies. It is difficult to understand that what has had a beginning should not also have an end. There are many things that you do not understand, because your intelligence is limited, but that is no reason for rejecting them. The child does not understand all that is understood by its father, nor does an ignorant man understand all that is understood by a learned one. We tell you that the existence of spirits has no end, that is all we can say on the subject at present. 84. Do spirits constitute a world apart from that which we see? Yes, the world of spirits or incorporeal intelligences. 85. Which of the two, the spirit world or the corporeal world, is the principal one in the order of the universe? The spirit world. It is pre-existent to, and survives, everything else. 86. Might the corporeal world never have existed, or ceased to exist, without changing the essentiality of the spirit world? Yes, they are independent of each other, and yet their correlation is incessant, for they react incessantly upon each other. 87. Do spirits occupy a determinate and circumscribed region in space? Spirits are everywhere, the infinitudes of space are peopled with them in infinite numbers. Unperceived by you, they are incessantly beside you, observing and acting upon you, for spirits are one of the powers of nature, and are the instruments employed by God for the accomplishment of His providential designs. But all spirits do not go everywhere. There are regions of which the entrance is interdicted to those who are less advanced. 88. Have souls a determinate, circumscribed, and unvarying form? Not for eyes such as yours, but, for us, they have a form, though one only to be vaguely imagined by you as a flame agleam, or an ethereal spark. Is this flame or spark of any color? If you could see it, it would appear to you to vary from a dull gray to the brilliancy of the ruby, according to the degree of the spirit's purity. 89. Do spirits employ any time in transporting themselves through space? Yes, but their motion is as rapid as that of thought. Is not thought the movement of the soul itself, a transportation of the soul itself to the place or the object thought of by it? Wherever the thought is, there the soul is, since it is the soul that thinks. Thought is an attribute. 90. When a spirit travels from one place to another, is he conscious of the distance he traverses and of the extent of space through which he passes, or is he suddenly transported to the place to which he wishes to go? A spirit can travel in either way. He can, if he will, take cognizance of the distance he passes through, or he can rid himself entirely of the sense of distance. This depends on the spirit's will, and also on his degree of purity. 91. Does matter constitute an obstacle to the movement of a spirit? No, spirits pass through everything. The air, the earth, water, fire, are equally accessible to them. 92. Have spirits the gift of ubiquity? In other words, can a spirit divide itself, or exist at several points of space at the same time? There can be no division of any given spirit, but every spirit is a center which radiates in all directions, and it is thus that a spirit may appear to be in several places at once. The sun is only one body, yet it radiates in all directions, and sends out its rays to great distances, but it is not divided. Have all spirits the same power of radiation? There is a great difference between them in this respect, it depends on the degree of their purity. 93. Is the spirit, properly so called, without a covering, or is it, as some declare, surrounded by a substance of some kind? The spirit is enveloped in a substance which would appear to you as mere vapor, but which, nevertheless, appears very gross to us, though it is sufficiently vaporous to allow the spirit to float in the atmosphere, and to transport himself through space at pleasure. 94. Whence does the spirit draw its semi-material envelope? From the universal fluid of each globe. For this reason, the bearer spirit is not the same in all globes. In passing from one globe to another, the spirit changes its envelope as you change a garment. When spirits who inhabit worlds of a higher degree than ours come among us, are they obliged to take on a grosser order of perispirit? Yes, they are obliged to clothe themselves with your matter in order to be able to enter your world. 95. Does the semi-material envelope of the spirit assume determinate forms, and can it become perceptible for us? Yes, it can assume any form that the spirit may choose to give to it. It is thus that a spirit is able sometime to make himself visible to you, whether in dreams or in your waking state, and can take a form that may be visible, and even palpable, for your senses. 96. Are all spirits equal, or does there exist among them a hierarchy of ranks? They are of different degrees according to the degree of purification to which they have attained. 97. Is there a fixed number of order or degrees of purification among spirits? The number of such orders is unlimited, because there is nothing much like a barrier or line of demarcation between the different degrees of elevation, and, therefore, as there are no fixed or arbitrary divisions among spirits, the number of orders may be increased or diminished according to the point of view from which they are considered. Nevertheless, if we consider the general characteristics of spirits, we may reduce them to three principal orders or degrees. We may place in the first or highest rank those who have reached the degree of relative perfection which constitutes what may be called pure spirits. We may place in the second rank those who have reached the middle of the accessional ladder, those who have achieved the degree of purification in which aspiration after perfection has become the ruling desire. We may place in the third or lowest rank all those imperfect spirits who are still on the lower rungs of the ladder. They are characterized by ignorance, the love of evil, and all the low passions that retard their progress upwards. 98. Have spirits of the second order only the aspiration after perfection? Have they also the power to achieve it? They have that power in degrees proportionate to the degree of purification at which they have severally arrived. Some of them are distinguished by their scientific knowledge, others by their wisdom and their kindness. But all of them have still to undergo the discipline of trial through temptation and suffering. 99. Are all spirits of the third order essentially bad? No. Some of them are inactive and neutral, not doing either good or evil. Others, on the contrary, take pleasure in evil, and are delighted when they find an opportunity of doing wrong. Others, again, are frivolous, foolish, fantastic, mischievous rather than wicked, tricky rather than positively malicious, amusing themselves by mystifying the human beings on whom they are able to act, and causing them various petty annoyances for their own diversion. 100. The classification of spirits is based upon the degree of their advancement, upon the qualities which they have acquired, and upon the imperfections from which they have still to free themselves. 101. Spirits may be subdivided into three principal classes with many subclasses. Third order bad spirits contain five subclasses, second order good spirits contain five subclasses, and first order pure spirits, of which there is only one class. 102. Tenth class impure spirits are inclined to evil, and make it the object of all their thoughts and activities. As spirits, they give to men perfidious counsels, stir up discord and distrust, and assume every sort of mask in order the more effectually to deceive. They beset those whose character is weak enough to lead them to yield to their suggestions, and whom they can draw aside from the path of progress, rejoicing when they are to retard their advancement by causing them to succumb under the appointed trials of the corporeal life. Spirits of this class may be recognized by their language, for the employment of coarse or trivial expressions by spirits, as by men, is always an indication of moral, if not of intellectual, inferiority. Their communications show the baseness of their inclinations, and though they may try to impose upon us by speaking with an appearance of reason and propriety, they are unable to keep up that false appearance, and end by betraying their real quality. The human beings in whom they are incarnated are addicted to all the vices engendered by vile and degrading passions. Sensuality, cruelty, roguery, hypocrisy, cupidity, avarice. They do evil for its own sake, without any definite motive, and, from hatred to all that is good, they generally choose their victims from among honest and worthy people. They are the pests of humanity, to whatever rank of society they belong, and the varnish of a civilized education is ineffectual to cure or to hide their degrading defects. 103. Ninth class, frivolous spirits. They are ignorant, mischievous, unreasonable, and addicted to mockery. They meddle with everything, and reply to every question without paying any attention to truth. They delight in causing petty annoyances, in raising false hopes of petty joys, in misleading people by mystifications and trickery. The spirits vulgarly called hobgoblins, will-o'-the-wisps, gnomes, etc., belong to this class. They are under the orders of spirits of a higher category, who make use of them as we do of servants. In their communications with men their language is often witty and facetious, but shallow. They are quick to seize the oddities and absurdities of men and things, on which they comment with sarcastic sharpness. If they borrow distinguished names, as they are fond of doing, it is rather for the fun of the thing than from any intention to deceive by so doing. 104. Eighth class spirits who pretend to more science than they possess. Their knowledge is often considerable, but they imagine themselves to know a good deal more than they know in reality. Having made a certain amount of progress from various points of view, their language has an air of gravity that may easily give a false impression as to their capacities and enlightenment, but their ideas are generally nothing more than the reflection of the prejudices and false reasoning of their terrestrial life. Their statements contain a mixture of truths and absurdities, in the midst of which traces of presumption, pride, jealousy, and obstinacy, from which they have not yet freed themselves, are abundantly perceptible. 105. Seventh class neutral spirits are not sufficiently advanced to take an active part in doing good, nor are they bad enough to be active in doing wrong. They incline sometimes to the one, sometime to the other, and do not rise above the ordinary level of humanity, either in point of morality or of intelligence. They are strongly attached to the things of this world, whose gross satisfactions they regret. 106. Sixth class, noisy and boisterous spirits. Spirits of this kind do not, strictly speaking, form a distinct class in virtue of their personal qualities. They may belong to all the classes of the third order. They often manifest their presence by the production of phenomena perceptible by the senses, such as raps, the movement and abnormal displacing of solid bodies, the agitation of the air, etc. They appear to be, more than any other class of spirits, attached to matter. They seem to be the principal agents in determining the vicissitudes of the elements of the globe, and to act upon the air, water, fire, and the various bodies in the entrails of the earth. Whenever these phenomena present a character of intention and intelligence, it is impossible to attribute them to a mere fortuitous and physical cause. All spirits are able to produce physical phenomena, but spirits of elevated degree usually leave them to those of a lower order, more apt for action upon matter than for the things of intelligence, and, when they judge it to be useful to produce physical manifestations, employ spirits of subaltern degree as their auxiliaries. 107. Second order good spirits and their general characteristics. Predominance of spirit over matter, desire of excellence. Their qualities and their power for good are proportionate to the degree at which they have arrived. Some of them possess scientific knowledge, others have acquired wisdom and charity, the more advanced among them combine knowledge with moral excellence. Not being yet completely dematerialized, they preserve the traces of their corporeal existence, more or less strongly marked, according to their rank, traces which are seen either in their mode of expressing themselves, in their habits, or even, in some cases, in the characteristic eccentricities and hobbies still retained by them. But for these weaknesses and imperfections they would be able to pass into the category of spirits of the first order. They have acquired the comprehension of the idea of God and of infinity, and already share the felicity of the higher spheres. They find their happiness both in the accomplishment of good and in the prevention of evil. The affection by which they are united affords them ineffable delight, troubled neither by envy, remorse nor any other of the evil passions which make the torment of spirits of lower degree, but they have still to undergo the discipline of trial until they have completed the work of their purification. As spirits, they infuse good and noble thoughts into the minds of men, turn them from the path of evil, protect those whose course of life renders them worthy of their aid, and neutralize by their suggestions the influence of lower spirits on the minds of those who do not willingly yield to the evil counsels of the latter. The human beings in whom they are incarnated are upright and benevolent. They are actuated neither by pride, selfishness, nor ambition. They feel neither hatred, rancor, envy, nor jealousy, and do well for its own sake. To this order belong the spirits commonly designated in the popular beliefs by the names of good genii, protecting genii, good spirits. In periods of ignorance and superstition, men have regarded them as beneficent divinities. They may be divided into four principal groups. 108. Fifth class benevolent spirits. Their dominant quality is kindness. They take pleasure in rendering service to men and in protecting them, but their knowledge is somewhat narrow. They have progressed in morality rather than in intelligence. 109. Fourth class, learned spirits. They are specially distinguished by the extent of their knowledge. They are less interested in moral questions than in scientific investigation, for which they have a greater aptitude, but their scientific studies are always prosecuted with a view to practical utility, and they are entirely free from the base passions common to spirits of the lower degrees of advancement. 110. Third class wise spirits. The most elevated moral qualities form their distinctive characteristics. Without having arrived at the possession of unlimited knowledge, they have reached a development of intellectual capacity that enables them to judge correctly of men and of things. 111. Second class high spirits. They unite, in a very high degree, scientific knowledge, wisdom, and goodness. Their language, inspired only by the purest benevolence, is always noble and elevated, often sublime. Their superiority renders them more apt than any others to impart to us just and true ideas in relation to the incorporeal world, within the limits of the knowledge permitted to mankind. They willingly enter into communication with those who seek for truth in simplicity and sincerity, and who are sufficiently freed from the bonds of materiality to be capable of understanding it, but they turn from those whose inquiries are prompted only by curiosity, or who are drawn away from the path of rectitude by the attractions of materiality. When, under exceptional circumstances, they incarnate themselves in this earth, it is always for the accomplishment of a mission of progress, and they thus show us the highest type of perfection to which we can aspire in the present world. 112. First order pure spirits. General characteristics. The influence of matter null. A superiority, both intellectual and moral, so absolute as to constitute what, in comparison with the spirits of all the other orders, may be termed perfection. 113. First and only class. They have passed up through every degree of the scale of progress, and have freed themselves from all the impurities of materiality. Having attained the sum of perfection of which created beings are susceptible, they have no longer to undergo either trials or expiations. Being no longer subject to reincarnation in perishable bodies, they enter on the life of eternity in the immediate presence of God. They are in the enjoyment of a beatitude which is unalterable, because they are no longer subject to the wants or vicissitudes of material life, but this beatitude is not the monotonous idleness of perpetual contemplation. They are the messengers and ministers of God, the executors of his orders in the maintenance of universal harmony. They exercise a sovereign command over all spirits inferior to themselves, aid them in accomplishing the work of their purification, and assign to each of them a mission proportioned to the progress already made by them. To assist men in their distresses, to excite them to the love of good or to the expiation of the faults which keep them back on the road to the supreme felicity, are for them congenial occupations. They are sometimes spoken of as angels, archangels, or seraphim. They can, when they choose to do so, enter into communication with men, but presumptuous indeed would he be who should pretend to have them at his orders. 114. Are spirits good or bad by nature, or are they the same spirits made better through their own efforts? The same spirits made better through their own efforts. In growing better they pass from a lower to a higher order. 115. Are some spirits created good and others created bad? God has created all spirits in a state of simplicity and ignorance, that is to say, without knowledge. He has given to each of them a mission, with a view to enlighten them and to make them gradually arrive at perfection through the knowledge of the truth, and thus to bring them nearer and nearer to himself. This perfection is, for them, the condition of eternal and unalloyed happiness. Spirits acquire knowledge by passing through the trials imposed on them by God. Some of them accept these trials with submission, and arrive more quickly at the aim of their destiny. Others undergo them with murmuring, and thus remain, through their own fault, at a distance from the perfection and the felicity promised to them. According to this statement, it would appear that spirits, at their origin, are like children, ignorant and without experience, but acquiring, little by little, the knowledge which they lack, by passing through the different phases of human life? Yes, The comparison is correct. The child, if rebellious, remains ignorant and faulty. He profits more or less according to his docility. But the life of man has a term, whereas that of spirits stretches out into infinity. 116. Do any spirits remain forever in the lower ranks? No, all become perfect. They change in course of time, however long may be the process of amendment, for, as we have already said, a just and merciful parent cannot condemn his children to eternal banishment. Can you suppose that God, so great, so good, so just, is less kind than you are? 117. Does it depend on the spirits themselves to hasten their progress towards perfection? Certainly, they reach the goal more or less quickly according to the strength of their desire and the degree of their submission to the will of God. Does not a docile child learn faster than one who is obstinate and idle? 118. Can spirits degenerate? No, in proportion as they advance, they understand what has retarded their progress. When a spirit has finished with any given trial, he has learned the lesson of that trial, and never forgets it. He may remain stationary, but never degenerates. 119. Could God exonerate spirits from the trials which they have to undergo in order to reach the highest rank? If they had been created perfect, they would not have merited the enjoyment of the benefits of that perfection. Where would be the merit without the struggle? Besides, the inequality which exists between spirits is necessary to the development of their personality, and, moreover, the mission which each spirit accomplishes at each step of his progress is an element of the providential plan for ensuring the harmony of the universe. 120. Do all spirits pass by the road of evil to arrive at good? Not by the road of evil, but by that of ignorance. 121. How is it that some spirits have followed the road of good, and others the road of evil? Have they not their free will? God has not created any spirits bad, He has created them simple and ignorant, that is to say, possessing an equal aptitude for good and for evil. Those who become bad become so of their own free will. 122. How can spirits, at their origin, when they have not yet acquired self-consciousness, possess freedom of choice between good and evil? Is there in them any principle, any tendency, which inclines them towards either road rather than towards the other? Free will is developed in proportion as the spirit acquires the consciousness of himself. Freedom would not exist for the spirit if his choice was solicited by a cause independent of his will. The cause which determines his choice is not in him, but is exterior to him, in the influences to which he voluntarily yields in virtue of the freedom of his will. It is this choice that is represented under the grand figure of the fall of man and of original sin. Some spirits have yielded to temptation, others have withstood it. Whence come the influences that act upon him? From the imperfect spirits, who seek to take possession of him and to dominate him, and who are happy to see him succumb. It is this temptation that is allegorically pictured as Satan. Does this influence act upon a spirit only at its origin? It follows him through all the phases of his existence as a spirit, until he has acquired such thorough self-command that evil spirits renounce the attempt to obsess him. 123. Why has God permitted it to be possible for spirits to take the wrong road? The wisdom of God is shown in the freedom of choice which He leaves to every spirit, for each has thus the merit of his deeds. 124. Since there are spirits who, from the beginning, follow unswervingly the right path, and others who wander into the lowest depths of evil, there are, no doubt, many degrees of deviation between these two extremes? Yes, certainly. And these degrees constitute the paths of the great majority of spirits. 125. Will the spirits who have chosen the wrong road be able to reach the same degree of elevation as the others? Yes, but the eternities will be longer in their case. 126. Are spirits who have reached the supreme degree after wandering into the wrong road less meritorious than the others in the sight of God? God regards the wanderers who have returned to the right road with the same approval and the same affection as the others. They have been classed, for a time, as evil spirits, because they succumbed to the temptation of evil, but, before their fall, they were merely neutral in regard to good and evil, like all other spirits. 127. Are all spirits created equal in point of intellectual capacity? They are all created equal, but not knowing from whence they come, for their free will must have its fling. They progress more or less rapidly in intelligence as in morality. 128. Do the beings whom we call angels, archangels, seraphim, form a special category of a nature different from that of other spirits? No, the spirits who have purified themselves from all imperfection, have reached the highest degree of the scale of progress, and united in themselves all species of perfection. The word angel is generally supposed to imply the idea of moral perfection, but it is often applied, nevertheless, to all beings, good or bad, beyond the pale of humanity. We say, a good angel, a bad angel, an angel of light, the angel of darkness, etc. In those cases, it is synonymous with spirit or genius. It is employed here in its highest sense. 129. Have the angels passed up through all the degrees of progress? They have passed up through all those degrees, but with the difference which we have already mentioned. Some of them, accepting their mission without murmuring, have reached the goal more quickly, others have been longer in reaching the same goal. 130. If the opinion which admits that some beings have been created perfect and superior to all others be erroneous, how is it that this opinion is to be found in the tradition of almost every people? Your world has not existed from all eternity. Long before it was called into being, hosts of spirits had already attained to the supreme degree. And, therefore, the people of your earth naturally supposed those perfected spirits to have always been at the same degree of elevation. 131. Are there any demons in the usual acceptation of that term? If demons existed, they would be the work of God, but would it be just on the part of God to have created beings condemned eternally to evil and to misery? If demons exist, it is in your low world, and in other worlds of similar degree, that they are to be found. They are the human hypocrites who represent a just God as being cruel and vindictive, and who imagine that they make themselves agreeable to him by the abominations they commit in his name. Chapter 2. Incarnation of spirits. 132. What is the aim of the incarnation of spirits? It is a necessity imposed on them by God, as the means of attaining perfection. For some of them it is an expiation, for others, a mission. In order to attain perfection, it is necessary for them to undergo all the vicissitudes of corporeal existence. It is the experience acquired by expiation that constitutes its usefulness. Incarnation has also another aim, that of fitting the spirit to perform his share in the work of creation, for which purpose he is made to assume a corporeal apparatus in harmony with the material state of each world into which he is sent, and by means of which he is enabled to accomplish the special work, in connection with that world which has been appointed to him by the divine ordering. He is thus made to contribute his quota towards the general wheel, while achieving his own advancement. 133. Is incarnation necessary for the spirits who, from the beginning, have followed the right road? All are created simple and ignorant, they gain instruction in the struggles and tribulations of corporeal life. God, being just, could not make some of them happy, without trouble and without exertion, and consequently without merit. But it so, what do spirits gain by having followed the right road, since they are not thereby exempted from the pains of corporeal life? They arrive more quickly at the goal. And besides, the sufferings of life are often a consequence of the imperfection of the spirit, therefore, the fewer his imperfections, the less will be his sufferings. He who is neither envious, jealous, avaricious, nor ambitious, will not have to undergo the torments which are a consequence of those defects. 134. What is the soul? An incarnate spirit. What was the soul before its union with a body? A spirit. souls and spirits are, then, the very same thing? Yes, souls are only spirits. Before uniting itself with a body, the soul is one of the intelligent beings who people the invisible world, and who temporarily assume a fleshly body in order to effect their purification and enlightenment. 135. Is there in man anything else than a soul and a body? There is the link which unites the soul and the body. What is the nature of that link? It is semi-material, that is to say, of a nature intermediate between soul and body, as it must necessarily be in order that they may be enabled to communicate with each other. It is by means of this link that the spirit acts upon matter, and that matter acts reciprocally upon the spirit. 136. Is the soul independent of the vital principle? The body is only the envelope of the soul, as we have repeatedly told you. Can a body exist without a soul? Yes, but it is only when the body ceases to live that the soul quits it. Previous to birth, the union between the soul and the body is not complete, but when this union is definitively established, it is only the death of the body that can sever the bonds that unite it to the soul, and thus allow the soul to withdraw from it. Organic life may vitalize a body without a soul, but the soul cannot inhabit a body deprived of organic life. What would our body be if it had no soul? A mass of flesh without intelligence, anything you choose to call it, except a man. 137. Can the same spirit incarnate itself in two different bodies at the same time? No, the spirit is indivisible, and cannot simultaneously animate two different beings. 138. What is to be thought of the opinion of those who regard the soul as being the principle of material life? That is a question of definition. We attach but slight importance to mere words. You should begin by agreeing among yourselves as to the exact meaning of the expressions you employ. 139. Certain spirits, and certain philosophers before them, have defined the soul as an animated spark that has emanated from the great whole. Why this contradiction? There is nothing contradictory in such a definition. Everything depends on the meaning you attribute to the words you use. Why have you not a word for each thing? 140. What is to be thought of the theory according to which the soul is subdivided into as many parts as there are muscles in the body, and thus presides over each of the bodily functions? That, again, depends on the meaning attached to the word soul. If by soul is meant the vital fluid, that theory is right. If the word is used to express an incarnate spirit, it is wrong. We have already told you that a spirit is indivisible. It transmits movement to the bodily organs through the intermediary fluids, but it undergoes no division. Nevertheless, there are spirits who have given this definition. Spirits who are ignorant may mistake the effect for the cause. 141. Is there any truth in the opinion of those who suppose that the soul is exterior to the body and environment? The soul is not shut up in the body like a bird in a cage. It radiates in all directions, and manifests itself outside the body as a light radiates from a glass globe, or as a sound is propagated from a sonorous center. In this sense, the soul may be said to be exterior to the body, but it is not therefore to be considered as enveloping the body. The soul has two envelopes. The first, or innermost, of these, of a light and subtle nature, is what you call the perispirit. The other, gross, material, heavy, is the body. The soul is the center of both these envelopes, like the germ in the stone of the fruit, as we have already said. 142. What is to be thought of that other theory according to which the formation of the soul of the child is carried on to completion during the successive periods of the human lifetime? The spirit is a unit and is as entire in the child as in the adult. It is only the bodily organs, or instruments of the manifestations of the soul, that are gradually developed and completed in the course of a lifetime. Here, again, you mistake the effect for the cause. 143. Why do not all spirits define the soul in the same way? All spirits are not equally enlightened in regard to these matters. Some spirits are still so little advanced intellectually as to be incapable of understanding abstract ideas, They are like children in your world. Other spirits are full of false learning, and make a vain parade of words in order to impose their authority upon those who listen to them. They, also, resemble too many in your world. And besides, even spirits who are really enlightened may express themselves in terms which appear to be different, but which, at bottom, mean the same thing, especially in regard to matters which your language is incapable of expressing dearly, and which can only be spoken of to you by means of figures and comparisons that you mistake for literal statements of fact. 144. What is to be understood by the soul of the world? The universal principle of life and intelligence from which individualities are produced. But, very often, they who make use of these terms do not know what they mean by them. The word soul is so elastic that everyone interprets it according to his own imaginings. Certain persons have also attributed a soul to the earth, which must be understood as indicating the assemblage of devoted spirits who direct your actions in the right direction when you listen to them, and who are, as it were, the lieutenants of God in the administration of your globe. 145. How is it that so many philosophers, both ancient and modern, have so long been discussing psychological questions without having arrived at the truth? Those men were precursors of the eternal truths of the true spiritist doctrine, for which they have prepared the way. They were men, and therefore subject to error, because they often mistook their own ideas for the true light, but their very errors have served the cause of truth by bringing into relief both sides of the argument. Moreover, among those errors are to be found many great truths which a comparative study of the various theories thus put forth would enable you to discover. 146. Has the soul a circumscribed and determinate seat in the body? No, but it may be said to reside more especially in the head, in the case of men of great genius and of all who think much, and in the heart, in the case of those who feel much, and whose actions have always a humanitarian aim. What is to be thought of the opinion of those who place the soul in a center of organic life? The spirit may be said to inhabit more especially such a part of your organism, because it is to such a part that all the sensations converge, but those who place it in what they consider to be the center of vitality confound it with the vital fluid or principle. Nevertheless, it may be said that the soul is more especially present in the organs which serve for the manifestation of the intellectual and moral qualities. 147. Why is it that anatomists, physiologists, and in general those who apply themselves to the pursuit of the natural sciences, are so apt to fall into materialism? The physiologist refers everything to the standard of his senses. Human pride imagines that it knows everything, and refuses to admit that there can be anything which transcends the human understanding. Science itself inspires some minds with presumption; they think that nature can have nothing hidden from them. 148. Is it not regrettable that materialism should be a consequence of studies which ought, on the contrary, to show men the superiority of the intelligence that governs the world? It is not true that materialism is a consequence of those studies; it is a result of the imperfection which leads men to draw a false conclusion from their studies, for men may make a bad use of the very best things. The idea of annihilation, moreover, troubles those who profess to hold it more than they will allow to be seen, and those who are the loudest in proclaiming their materialistic convictions are often more boastful than brave. The great number of the so-called materialists are only such because they have no rational ground of belief in a future life. Show a firm anchor of rational belief in a future state to those who see only a yawning void before them, and they will grasp it with the eagerness of drowning men.